Welcome to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform. Welcome to the show, guys. Today we're joined by Joe Allen. Joe is Research Associate at UK Data Service.
It's not a particularly useful title, just straight off the bat.
It's also very difficult to say.
it's not a very useful one because it doesn't really explain what I do. So basically, the title is Research Associate, and I think a lot of my co-workers have the same title. But what we really do is we make data-related training materials for the UK Data Service. Now I've got to define UK Data Service. So the UK Data Service is the UK's largest collection of sort of social and economic data, so the Census 2021 data that's going around at the moment. In 100 years, that will be made publicly available, and I imagine it will be made publicly available through the UK Data Service. So you can, on there, see the census data from 100 years ago. You can see various organizations' open data, and they try and help people not only access that data, but deposit their own data they might have. And they try and make sort of training materials. Here's how you can use this data, merge it, work with this data legally within your sort of academic research. But you can use it for other reasons as well. But yeah, there's a lot of sort of juicy data in there that would normally basically be illegal to use. You know, we wouldn't be able to share that data, especially with GDPR stuff. But the UK Data Service takes on all that stuff, takes on the paperwork, will email you and remind you that you have to sign forms so that you can legally use this data, what you're legally allowed to use that data for. So it's quite a big, strange organization. And I'm in what's called the computational social science team. Again, another word that people don't really know about or think about. So that is sort of this new art of joining social science with computer science. And what that means is, in a traditional computer science sense, we would sort of look at a big problem, abstract some solution out of it, and implement something. You know, we'd make a website, we'd write some code, we'd do something. The social science part of that is about, okay, what's the problem here? So we might say, oh, we think that some of the schools in Manchester have high levels of pollution, right? That's an easy human problem. We both know what I'm talking about there. Then the computer scientists might say, okay, well, we've got these sensors here. We can access these sensors by calling these RESTful APIs and, you know, amalgamating all of that into some SQL database. It means nothing to normal people. And then the end of that, we go back into sort of that social science brain, and we might pick up some qualitative data. We might pick up how people perceive the pollution around their schools. We might ask kids whether they have trouble breathing, how many kids have asthma, and sort of join all these data sets. And we'll kind of tell a story, and we can sort of say, you know, over these 20 years, we've seen this increase in cars, and we've also seen this increase in asthma. And these are the schools that are worst affected, and here's what we think the government should do about it. So it's kind of taking that human problem, making it a computer problem, and then bringing it out the end as a human problem again, so it can actually be useful. And then, yeah, my job generally is just, I lovingly call it a data content creator. So I write blog posts, I make, the bulk of the job is preparing training materials. So I'm working on something for synthetic data at the moment, synthetic data training. So that's trying to make sort of a version of data that can be more reliably shared, but it would still be illegal to share because it's based on real data, but it basically protects the individuals. And then the other big thing I'm looking at the moment is just Twitter analytics and doing things like analyzing the sentiment of Twitter over time. So the big one at the moment is just the perception of veganism over time. And you can basically classify words that are sort of positive or negative. And from that, you can find like the sentiment of something over time, but you can also grab the most negative perceptions of something at those times or the most positive perception of that thing at a time. Generally, you get some absolutely like foul tweets, like some of the most like sexist tweets I've ever seen. And it's slightly comedic, but also horrifying when you're like giving a tech demo and something just incredibly sexist comes up as like the random tweet it's plucked to sort of demo. So it's very interesting, and it's very sort of social data, and it's surprisingly easy to use because a lot of these big platforms want to make it easy for you to use. But yeah, that's my job at the moment. And you'll notice that although I'm talking a lot today about sort of data science and machine learning, there's not a lot of data science there. It's not a traditional data science role. And really, I think that's a symptom of data science. So we've got this big title that we think represents data analytics and machine learning and all sorts of stuff like that. But really, it's a very, very new field. And because of that, every organization has their sort of their own different spin on what a data scientist is and what a data scientist must do, how much of that work is actually about sort of neural networks and really cool stuff, how much of it is, oh, we don't actually have the data yet, or we need somebody to, you know, mix all this data together, make this database for us. And you're really sort of joining these big organizations on this journey to try and figure out how this can even be useful and try and sort of glean a product from within an organization. So I always sort of describe it as, in my ideal, you're sort of this internal consultant, and they know that you're good at these things and they know that you have these skills, but it's on you to sort of have the eye for the product. And again, similar to that computational social science, you know, you can't just say, okay, if we do this thing, if we change these buttons green and do this stuff, profit will go up 5%. You have to have a story, right? You have to say, oh, we need our users to feel that this website is more friendly than it is, so we're going to use these skills to do this stuff, and then at the end there'll be more profit, right? You have to have both those skills. It's a really weird job like that. You can't really be a data scientist and sort of sit in the background and not really communicate with people. From what I've seen, it's, you know, you get a data science job and now you're a data analyst, you're a machine learning engineer, you're probably a business analyst, product manager, project manager, and you have to like fight your own battles in many ways. So it's a really exhausting but very exciting job. And if we do go into like my background before that, I was, you know, my first job, I was a web dev. Second job, I was a web dev. And while I was there, I saw sort of the data science side and I thought, that looks really interesting. And they saw me and they would go, oh, this guy can help us make a dashboard. He can do this website stuff. So I transitioned into that. So I got a job as a data scientist at a company called Laterooms.com.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, big one in Manchester. And yeah, again, it was that internal consultant role. You could really ask whatever question you wanted. We would do stuff like try and figure out the relationship between the hotel descriptions for a hotel and what star rating they actually had. And the initial assumption being, you know, again, talking about those positive and negative sentiments, I would think the more a sort of the higher your star rating, the more positive your stars would be. That's a easy assumption to make, right? Maybe the 5-star ones, like we're this glamorous, gorgeous hotel, we have beautiful pools, stuff like that. But what we actually saw is this sort of like bell curve where 1- and 2-star hotels had the same sort of sentiment that 4- and 5-star hotels had, and 3-star hotels had the peak. And what it looked like it was that basically the 5- and 4-star hotels were confident. So they didn't brag. They didn't say like, oh, we have beautiful, clean bathrooms. We've got an amazing, huge swimming pool.
Yeah.
To them, it was like, we wouldn't even mention that we had a clean bathroom because obviously we have a bathroom, obviously it's clean. And then you had these 3-star hotels like trying to sort of brag their way into looking like a 4- and 5-star hotel. So it's these really interesting little things you find. And then you think like, who's this useful for? Yeah. And there's like so many stories like that. And it's a weird one because I think it's quite strange because machine learning is definitely in public perception right now, but as somebody in it, it's quite hard to tell how much of it externally looks quite magical. Like, yeah. I don't know what's the perception you have of like, you see these kind of things where somebody's like generating new celebrities from pictures or something's being racist and like calculating sentences for prisoners and stuff like that. You know, I don't know what it looks like from the outside.
Yeah. Well, it's really, really interesting because, you know, obviously I've spoken to a lot of people in this industry over the past like year or so, and it's like, it still fascinates me about kind of machine learning and AI and things like that. I mean, I don't think the, you know, like, I don't want to say general public, but I don't think people that, you know, really work in the industry actually know what's going on to the extent that it is.
Mm.
Not that it's behind closed doors or anything like that, or it's a secret. It's just, I don't think, you know, people really realize how fast these changes are being made and how powerful it actually is. And I mean, particularly with data, the more I've learned about data and the more I've spoken about it, I find it absolutely fascinating. And that's such, you know, if you, I always say, if you speak to like, you know, I don't know, my cousin or something, or my housemate about data. I think as soon as you mention the word data, their eyes kind of glaze over and lose interest.
That's okay.
almost immediately.
Mine too, don't worry.
But I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah, it's a weird one because there's this sort of, I often call it like sort of an education piece of work or sort of an ambition piece of work almost, where we used to have, you know, people used to sort of say, okay, we've got this thing with tech, let's make a website, let's solve this sales problem, let's do this thing. And it seems like for a long while, maybe we were told no. You know, we would get told like, oh, that's too expensive, that's too difficult, we can't do that. Now you can sort of Google, you know, machine learning, transcribe all my phone calls, and there'll be something that does it, and it costs like 50p. And, you know, it'll process like thousands of hours of phone calls for like $20. And these are the kind of things I think people are unlearning now that they were impossible, you know, yeah. And we're beginning to, a lot of data scientists are kind of the people that have been going to like meetups, and they've seen these talks where someone's like, oh, here's how I analyze the sentiment analysis of this. Here's how I predicted the outcome of these football matches and all this kind of stuff. And where it's sort of flicking that switch back. But then within a big organization, you know, you've got 300 employees and you've got like two or three data scientists that are there thinking like, oh, we could double the amount of money by changing the rankings of these hotels, or we could change this and it would have this huge knock on. And you're the only person that's kind of like aware of what can be done there. And it's your job to sell it to people who will then be very thankful that you've doubled the income. You know, we had again at Late Rooms, we had this amazing thing. I often find that it's like quite difficult to describe what machine learning is in a business context and how it can be useful. And a way I used to describe it was, imagine if like every time somebody went on your website, you had an employee at Late Rooms that was watching them. A very surreal, scary image, but you're watching them and you might notice, you know, somebody might hover over a button that says weekend getaways. They might not click it. They might not engage with it. They might leave it there for like a minute. As a human watching that, you're thinking, oh, this person probably wants to go away for a weekend. Or you might see that maybe they're scrolling slowly through the page. Maybe they're checking at, you know, 11 a.m. in the morning on a mobile phone. These little things, you look at them and you think, okay, if you're checking on a phone, you're probably not going to book it. 11 a.m., you're probably at work. You're probably not going to book it. You're probably browsing something for later. The sort of UX side of me is thinking, oh, we should make it easy for this person to find this later. You know, they shouldn't be opening 100 tabs, sending them to their partner. You know, we need a favorite system. These are the kind of things that a human will look at this system and they'll go, oh yeah, that makes sense. I understand this user. So machine learning is really useful for not needing those thousands of people, where if you can notice that somebody's scrolling through a page slowly, somebody's on the page at a particular time of day, or it's sunny outside, these are all things that we can easily use. And, you know, there are a lot of assumptions we can make. A big one we had was like, if it's raining, people are more likely to book a hotel. Like at its surface, it doesn't sound like much, but I know personally, and this is where it comes from. You know, we sit there anecdotally. Yeah. I would look outside. I live in Manchester. I'd look outside. I'd see an awful gray day. I'd see some of the worst rain I've seen in a couple of months. And I'd be thinking, why am I here? I should go to Portugal. And yeah, that will be when I go look on like Google Flights or Late Rooms or whatever. And it's those little assumptions, and you look at them and they just make sense as a human. And if they make sense as a human, and they're basically these just simple heuristics, you know, is it raining here? Is this person on a phone? Is it after 5 p.m. and they're probably not at work? You know, things like that. These little questions called like heuristics that are just simple if statements. And machine learning is just that up a notch. You know, it's in many cases, the logic sort of disappears. You don't have, at the end, they don't say this person booked because it's raining, because it's here. It's much more nuanced than that. It might be that like, oh, it's been cloudy for the last 5 days. And when it's cloudy 5 days in a row, that creates this sense of foreboding, surreal depression or something like that. It's stuff that, yeah, as humans, we won't get. And we had, again, at Late Rooms, we tried this out because it's not hard to try out. We had a look at every time someone lands on the page, we immediately know hundreds of things about them. But some basic stuff we know is like, you know, obviously we know the time of day when they're on the site. We know where they are to the city level. So we can get Manchester, but at a higher level, obviously we know countries, time of day, yeah, day of the week. You know, the kind of things that are just obvious.
Yeah.
But really, if you look at them, the majority of bookings will take place on weekends or after work. And then you can ask, you know, what could we do on weekends after work? We could turn adverts off. We can make the experience better in the evenings when someone's trying to book. The flip side of that, if we know that somebody isn't going to book anything, we can still monetize them, right? We can still show them websites. There are some adverts that you will receive money for just by people seeing them, not even with click-through stuff. So there's all sorts of like crazy ways to do this. And it becomes this huge game of like 100 little things to change. But yeah, that system of just looking at where they are, what time of day is, what device they're on, we could predict whether somebody was going to book a hotel with 70% accuracy. So it's quite huge, you know, it's better than flipping a coin. Yeah. And there are certain, and that was, you know, our first pass. There's always like, we could dedicate hundreds of hours to a similar project and we could probably bump that way higher. But it's, you know, if we're sat there and saying like, okay, 90% accuracy, we know this person's going to book, it means absolutely nothing. You have to give it to like a UX person, a designer, a product owner. They have to say, you know, you have to again flip that switch and they have to be sat there saying, okay, I know this person's going to book a hotel. What can I do for them? What can I help? Do I upsell? Does the upsell not work? All these crazy things. And you're just thinking at like 100 miles per hour to something that what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago was impossible. And it's just all these little like switches that you can change. It's very strange, very strange world.
Yeah. We were talking about how, you know, powerful data is. I mean, that's incredible, isn't it? I mean, you know, you think humans are like, you know, not that readable, you know, but if you put all their actions down to paper, not paper, but you know, if you put all their actions down to data, it's crazy how easy we are to kind of read, you know.
Yeah, it's a weird one because there's so many little things that you would never try and quantify. Like if you ask me now, like how much I've been exercising recently, I might like pause for a couple of seconds. I might downplay my exercise. I might upplay it. I might lie to you. I might say that I exercise every day. I might say that I never exercise when in fact I probably do once a week or something. And all these little things that as a human, we pick up that intonation. We pick up whether somebody's exhausted. But if you just copy the words I say, and you were a computer, you'd be like, oh, this person is perfect. This person exercises every day. And it's these weird assumptions that we have to make, again, to turn these like human problems into sort of an abstracted computational problem. And then there's all sorts of danger that comes with that. You know, we perpetuate biases. There's all sorts of crazy things down that route. But yeah, there's more pressure now to sort of try and do these things ethically over try and do them to sort of convert people into money and things like that. So it's better, but I think it's a sign of just, again, it's a very new industry, right? These, when people recruit data scientists, they don't really know what they're looking for. And when people try and get a job as a data scientist, they don't really know what to showcase as well. So it's kind of like a problem from both angles. And we're really asking for anyone recruiting a data scientist to like understand this industry that's like as broad as it is deep, make assumptions on what's even possible, not as data people trying to figure out what they can do, if anything. Countless people I know have been like hired as a data scientist and then they've had to spend like a year or two just tidying up the data before they can actually do the big project they were initially hired to do. My old advice to companies used to be hire a data engineer before a data scientist. To define that, a data engineer would be somebody who sort of helps move data between places. You might do some sort of transformation, you might tidy stuff up, but you don't have to. But that's a huge assumption that people have. You know, they read a blog post, say, oh, we get a data scientist, our profit will go up 10%. But really they come in and the first thing they do is they say, okay, give me the data. And then you can't, or there's some reason you can't export something, or there's some business logic that means that these things are separate and can never ever be connected. And it's all these big things that just mean that it's not, you know, the job that people will study for in university. It's not the job that they'll write on their CV, but it's also that they won't be hired for it. You know, they'll be hired for their deep learning skills and their neural network knowledge. But then really they'll get in there and it'll be about how much they can sort of hustle, how much they can start meetings with people that they weren't really supposed to be talking about, how much they can sort of try and empower and automate those different roles. And yeah, it's a really strange one. And again, back to that ambition, you know, you don't hire that person and they come in and they say, here's like 50 ideas of what we can do and who I need to talk to. They've seen a talk online that says, here's how to do this for sentiment analysis. They've seen, you know, a talk at a meetup, not in the last year, obviously, but they've seen a talk at a meetup that might have been, you know, here's how we use this to do this. And it's, yeah, it's really just getting those people into a space where those people are then trusted. And it's a really hard thing to figure out sort of externally looking at any company.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I mean, there's one of my thoughts, which is, you know, as a data scientist how do you look at data objectively with like no bias? Does it depend on the quality of the data? Is that the most...
In a lot of cases, you can't. In a lot of cases, you'll be given... It's an interesting one, actually. In academia or in any application process, you'll be handed this like golden data set that's perfect and there's no data missing. You can trust everything. It's well documented. And if there is anything missing, it's intentional. It's part of the test, right? They'll be like, oh, deal with these missing values or these sort of outliers and things like that. But when you get to the real data set, you'll see that like 10% of the rows are complete. The rest of it is just completely missing data. And you get to things like there's something called imputation, which is where you look at some columns and you infer another column. So an example might be, we might have ages and shoe sizes of children, and we might need to infer whether they're male or female, assuming that there's two genders in this data set. And in a lot of cases, you'll see that, you know, as age increases, shoe size increases, obviously. And with males, the shoe size will increase with a slightly steeper gradient. It might be safe to assume anybody above a line is male, anybody below it is female, right? That seems like a reasonably safe thing to say, but there will be some females that have larger feet. There will be some, some people that grow larger feet when they're smaller and all sorts of stuff like that, right? We can't just make this assumption that it's a straight line that we can put things above and below, but sometimes we have to. And it's this weird process of, you know, what assumptions can we make? What help us deliver this metric without us becoming these like ethical monsters and doing all this stuff like that? And, you know, we're not just talking about shoe sizes and ages here, obviously. This goes to, you know, sometimes we assume that a whole postcode might represent a particular race or a particular religion. And sometimes that's a reasonable assumption to do so. But obviously there's going to be outliers where somebody isn't a Hasidic Jew in a particular postcode. And what does that mean for the analysis we're doing? And it's a tricky one. And I think I like to think that we're past the point where we blindly ignore that. And we're kind of in this area where, you know, there's a lot of data scientists now that will refuse to use postcodes for anything. They think it's such like a dangerous, loaded sort of bias field thing where you've got like hundreds of years of history restricted to a particular postcode. But yeah, there's always a bias and there's always sort of this choice where we say, you know, do we try and echo what this data is telling us, or do we try and fix something, or do we? And the problem is when we say, let's fix it, we're just putting our own bias in it now. Absolutely. You know, we're saying that like, okay, let's acknowledge trans people, but let's not acknowledge this other thing. We always have these issues that are now present, but there'll always be something new in sort of the face of equality. And it's a really tricky thing to think about, but you know, it's always going to be better than ignoring it altogether. There was like the famous thing a few years ago where they used machine learning to predict the sentences for trials, and it used postcode or something like that.
Yeah,
which basically meant that black people got sentenced harsher. I think like black males got sentenced harsher than black females and all sorts of other stuff like that. Very dangerous world. But you have to remember that, you know, these machines are learning from biased data that we give them. So that bias is still real. You know, we're still, if we're making parity with that, it's okay, but it's not good. That's the sort of view I have on that.
Yeah. And I find it really interesting that, you know, I don't want to say normal people again. I mean, like the public who don't work in data science or, you know, that kind of industry, it's like they almost get, I mean, particularly even you've seen it now more recently with data being put into the real world with COVID. I mean, but it amazes me that people go, oh, no, that's the data. That's the data, as in the data is the answer. And that's totally black and white, right and wrong. And it's like, there's that common misconception that that's the way it is. And it's like, you know, at the end of the story of data across that data line, then there is a human decision. There is a human like figuring out the story within that data. And it is not always black and white, right and wrong. You know, it is kind of open to interpretation to an extent. Would you agree?
Yeah, I always say, like I've said for the last year, this whole COVID year has been an excellent science experiment. Like, it's been lovely to see, like, oh, this is how people react to this thing. Here's how people react to different restrictions. Here's how, you know, misconceptions and data sort of perpetuate through the media. It's been really good for that. But it's, I've never seen like a more transparent period of sort of, you know, false narratives and things like that. We've seen, even as recently as like the AstraZeneca vaccine getting pulled in other countries, we've seen that, you know, the data scientist in me and many other data scientists will look at, okay, there's blood clots associated with this vaccine compared to what? How many people normally get a blood clot? How many people got blood clots on the other vaccines? And that there's been great visualizations. We've seen great graphics. But then, as you say, there's always narratives, right? There's always, okay, this R number converts to this tier system. Where was that R number calculated? I'm not really sure. It's not really part of this news report. It's not part of this announcement. Sometimes it is, sometimes it doesn't make sense. And yeah, it just shows like how complicated these systems are. And I think all we're really seeing is, you know, those pressures I was talking about in industry, it's like pressure to do something with the data. We're just seeing that to 1,000 times. We're seeing that with media intercepting that and saying, okay, I know somebody who saw this, who calculated this, they say this. And there's always a source that will back up the claim that you currently have about schools being opened or schools being closed. But really, it's all going to come back to, you know, what narrative is there? Can we say that, oh, kids need to go to school, otherwise something bad's going to happen, or kids don't need to go to school, otherwise something's bad going to happen? You know, there's so much there. It feels very transparent to me, but that's because I'm looking at it with that data science eye and thinking like, oh, I'd like to see this data. I'd like to see where they're getting this from, why this decision was made. But we probably will never see some of those conversations, right? And there's always going to be ulterior motives, whether they're malicious or ignorant. That's just the data world.
Yeah. And also, data is very much in the eye of the beholder. It's like you can see the answer that you want in data. And I think that's quite a dangerous thing. And that opens it up to being subjective again. But it's like you can find what you want to find, I guess. You can find what answer you want to find and, you know, whether it's right or wrong. And I think the general public believe the word data to be absolutely 100% correct, and they don't realize there is someone making decisions around it, which is quite worrying, but it's the way it is.
Yeah, you'd hope so. You'd hope it would be correct. But I think that's what draws a lot of people to sort of the data science world. Like, you can kind of make sense of this weird fuzziness, but really, as you're saying, you just embed yourself in that fuzziness so much. And if you go in, obviously you'll have biases, but you know, if you go in hoping something can happen, you'll make it happen, whether it's a good idea or not, whether you know, there'll always be a cost if you sort of increase the ability to sell something. You're doing it because you've tricked somebody in some way or you've enhanced some part of the process. And it's a really tricky sort of entire world just to be in, yeah. And there's so much money in it that it's looking so attractive right now. Like, I I'll say it a lot, but I like to think we're past these phases, but we do see a lot of blog posts that are like, data science is the sexiest job in the world. You need a data scientist, build a team of data scientists to do this. And it's, yeah, I worry because it seems it's setting up these people to be this like quick win.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then it's a whole job. And these people are getting hired as like the company's first data scientist. And they went to like 1,000 people company as an individual. And their job is now to learn how to navigate that entire system of 1,000 people whilst also doing some of the most technical work there is. So yeah, you get some like crazy ideas out of it. And every single company seems to create their own, you know, problems and solutions to like the world of data. It's very, very strange.
You know, I want to kind of find out about how, you know, how you started in the industry. I mean, so you went to, did you study at university or have I just made that up?
Yeah, I'll go through. So I did in A-levels, I was doing computer science and maths, and I always jumped between them. And I was always like, oh, I'm not really feeling computer science today. I'd love to do some maths. And then I go like, oh, I've had enough maths recently. I'm going to do some computer science. So I continued that to do a computer science and math degree at uni. And it's very weird because in data science, you get so many people that are like, they've left academics to join the industry. And you see a huge population of like PhD students from social sciences or from non-mathematical or computer science backgrounds that have essentially self-taught themselves how to be machine learning, how to be statistical, how to be researchy. And you, so you see a lot of companies, as I was saying, every company is different, but you see a lot of companies that have a very sort of research-based focus to their work, and they will still write papers, and they'll still write papers with universities on how to better sell cars, on how to better rank different products on a homepage. It's really, really weird. My academic journey stopped with a bachelor's, but it has been like a very pressing, you know, it seems like 25% of the jobs I apply for in the data science world expect a PhD. And it seems like you join teams where it's all PhD, it's all researching. I find it very weird. And then at the same time, we have people now getting a master's in data science, which again, to me, you know, I've heard hiring managers say that doesn't mean anything to me. Because it's the discrepancy between academia, as I was saying, with like that golden fine data set, and then what you get in the real world is so far apart. And if you can't navigate people and product manage and do all that kind of stuff, you don't get anywhere with it. You don't get anywhere with like the right skills. It's really weird. So I did just the bachelor's, and I was working as a web developer at Late Rooms, and I wanted to move to the data science team, which I did. So that was, I guess, the application process you would normally see for a data science role would be send a CV, you get an introductory phone call with the person where they'll ask you some technical questions, try and get an idea of who you are. Next, you will normally have like a tech test, very common in like software engineering, that you might be asked to build a website that does this, something like that, or write an API that does this, depending on whether it's sort of front end or back end. Now, the problem is with data science, as we've said, there's so many different things you can do. How do you test someone for the job, especially when every job is different? So very, very common thing you'll see is that they'll have a clean version of the data set that you might play with when you get there. It might be like hotel sales or something like that. It might be messed up a little bit. And they'll, the prompt I got a lot was find 3 insights in a data set.
Cool.
Which is like, you know, what's an insight, right? Like, does that mean use machine learning to predict something? Does that mean say the average number of sales? You know, the difference there is huge. And very frequently you'll get told, you know, oh, don't spend more than 2 or 3 hours on this. But if you're somebody trying to get your first job in data science, so you might find that 2 or 3 hours does nothing for you, and you spend, you know, 30, 40 hours trying to come up with something that you feel would be on par with other people, then some companies will then ask you to present your insights as well. So you'll have to give a presentation. So this is like a huge amount of work for a job you might not even get. And I've had like big companies in central Manchester have asked me to do this, do the insights, do the presentation, and I've sent them the slides, asked what the next step is, and got nothing in return. Really? And these are like organizations way big, like names that I would say that anyone on the podcast will know. And it's so strange to me that, like, I have a huge bugbear with like this whole tech test thing, and I'll happily do a tech test, but I have public code, I have like presentations recorded of me. You know, I'm kind of primed to be the kind of person that says, hey, I don't want to do your tech tests. I've already done a lot of tech tests. Can you accept these tech tests? But when you're new to the industry, you don't do that. You don't think that you're allowed to have a backbone. You don't think that you're allowed to say no to things. And it also, you know, it puts off if there are people that don't want to do your tech tests, or people that don't have time, people that are parents as well as full-time employed while looking for the job, they're not going to have those 30 hours to do something. So unless they can actually do it in a couple of hours, they just won't do it. You'll lose those sort of like top candidates. You get those tech tests. And then after that, you normally have an interview. So after you've done that, you've not even met this person beyond a phone call yet. And that's normally sort of a jumping off point for the interview. And it's very weird because you get, again, that ocean is so wide. People will ask you, you know, how a particular algorithm works. And it'll be the first time you've ever heard that algorithm. And it depends on, you know, if you did do a master's in data science, or if you do you know, lean heavily on the machine learning. Personally, machine learning has been 5% of 100% of the job. You know, it's not what's tested. It just seems to be what's easy to interview. And then none of that process is about really, you know, how well can you communicate with people? How well can you elicit a problem from a data set and make it into something? And if you could do those things, why would you do them in a tech test for somebody? You know, it's a crazy huge amount of work. So yeah, I got a job at Late Rooms, did that sort of internal consultant thing for a little while. And then after about 6 months, they made the whole data science team redundant. And there was like a huge thing with Late Rooms about redundancies and where they are now.
Oh, wow.
Went back into looking for a job. And again, saw all of this stuff again, right? I had 6 months experience as a data scientist, was just seeing all of this, you know, I don't have a PhD, can't apply for that one. Don't know this algorithm, can't apply for that one. So yeah, still very confident in those skills, but just, you know, my answer to a lot of those questions is, I don't know what that is. Tell me what it is. I'm willing to learn it. I have learned Python. I can do this. I can do this. I'm happy to learn something. I'm happy to do these things, but I just don't know, you know, this checkbox you have right now. And sometimes you get the complete opposite side of the spectrum where they'll get you to like write code on a piece of paper and stuff like that. So it's just, again, a symptom that data science is a newer industry, I think.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
You know, we're not sure how to test it really. Went back to being a web dev because the recruitment process was so painful that really? I was just like, you know what? Yeah, if I do web dev, I can get a job in a week. And I did. I got a job in a week. And the process was so respectful. I met some like amazing people that, you know, they would just send me a message on Slack and they'd be like, hey, can you come interview in like an hour? It was none of this.
Yeah.
It was none of this like weirdness. It was none of this like, okay, we've booked your interview 3 weeks from now and we'll offer you the job. It was literally, come here, you're great. Start next week, please. You know, and you can say, no, I'm going on holiday for a week. And then I did go on holiday for a week, came back. You know, it was amazing that I'd gone from this like insanely like abusive and strange data science recruitment process to like back to this mature web dev world where people were like, yep, you tick these boxes, sound like you're willing to learn, cool, you can do this, maybe you can help this. And annoyingly, one of the reasons they hired me as the web developer was because I had data science skills. And it was right. Because they wanted to see how those data science skills could work in their industry, but they have budget for web development, so they hire a web developer. So it's easier to hire a web developer who can sort of spend one day a week telling you that this data isn't good, please give me this and I can do this and stuff like that. So it was the same kind of system. And then from there, I left to join a startup where machine learning and stuff was the actual product. And that's a very different, you know, different from Late Rooms where you're this internal consultant. This is where sort of that research view and the sort of PhD side, they kind of benefit because they know how to answer one question very well for 3 years, right? That's their skill set. They know how to, when their boss says, oh, but will this still be true if we do this thing, if temperature increases, if all this other stuff happens, they know how to rebut that because they know all the data inside and out. So that was for a sort of a mining company in a very weird way, like building a product that could calculate how much material was flowing through it. And it was quite basic from a sort of data science perspective. The job again was, you know, grabbing data from different sites, being confident remotely accessing data and just merging it into data sets, dealing with time zones, like 100 small problems, but they all sort of add up. And then at the end of it, you have to sort of defend why something is or isn't correct. And then after that, I got this job. So that was this one. Very weirdly, alongside all of that, when I got made redundant at Late Rooms, me and my boss were like, we need something to do that's still going to be data related because we got a lot of time. We were like held there for like 6 weeks at least to like serve out redundancy. So we started something called Pi Data Manchester, which does have its own podcast and all sorts of stuff like that. Excellent. So that's where we run normally a monthly code night, a monthly podcast, and a monthly meetup. And weirdly, this job, someone sent me this job spec and they were like, this sounds perfect. And it was literally said like, you know, knows Python, knows data science skills, can run a podcast, can run events, can do all this. And I was like, wow, that sounds exactly like what I do for free for some reason. Yeah. So I applied and I got it and they seemed pretty happy with me. And I've been here for like 6 months now. So it's going pretty groovy. But yeah, it's again, symptoms of like, you know, the industry isn't really mature. It doesn't really know what it is. And because of that, recruitment's so frustrating. I can confidently apply for things that aren't data science roles. You know, the title research associate, it's not scary because I've somehow built this filter where a title means absolutely nothing, because anybody can say they're a data scientist, or anybody can say this team is their data scientist. I know a company in Manchester that overnight they had an analytics team, and overnight they changed everyone's title to data scientist, and they were now a data science team. So these people that traditionally had had no machine learning experience or anything are now, you know, one of the largest data science teams in Manchester. I feel like I've kept that vague enough to not say who it is.
I can't figure out who it is. But
you just hear things like this, and it's completely normal, and it's really weird. I think in like the early 2000s, there was this job title called, I think, webmaster or something like that. I don't think it exists anymore, but it was sort of, you know, the one person at your company that like made the website, made the databases if they needed to, made any backend stuff. We'll like set up your mail servers. We'll probably give you your laptop and all sorts of stuff. And they were just like this one size fits all. And I think data science is like sadly somewhat in that stage. And we're seeing this like split into, you know, data engineer, machine learning engineer, data analyst. But there's all sorts of like weird titles that exist in like certain cities and things like that that are just, they don't really mean anything. And it's no surprise that like candidates are frustrated. People doing a master's in data science are frustrated. People trying to hire a data scientist are frustrated. Like, you know, there's a big mistake happening, but it's not surprising. It's so complicated. It's, you know, you can't really group something. You can't really simplify it. You can't make a trivial interview process that makes that work. So really all, I think about it a lot, and I try to like come up with, you know, an ethical way to recruit data scientists. And I have a blog post that like outlines that. But it's still, you know, I recognize it's a really complicated thing to do, to hire anybody. It's obviously, you know, it makes sense if you can ask people to do free work and they'll do the free work. You can ask them. But I always wonder, you know, is there something better we can do? Is there something more sort of equal that we can do where we sort of equally give up time instead of people doing presentations and things like that? So, yeah, it all seems a bit messy. But that was years ago as well. I'm hoping that, you know, I don't hear about this stuff as much as I used to. It does seem that it's sort of growing in some way. But yeah, I don't know how much there is left to that journey, I suppose.
It seems that every company that's hiring for, say, like a data science role, or even sometimes like an engineering role and things like that, or, you know, a lot of them think that like, or seem to think that their role is the most important role in the country, and that's why it's going to take, you know, 3 weeks for us to do this, and that's why you're going to have to spend all day every day doing this tech test or whatever. And it's like, I don't know, it just seems like there must be a better way to go about it, and people just haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah, I think the thing is, when a company, you know, largest companies like 200 employees have probably hired 50 web developers in the last 5 years, but they're probably hiring the first data scientists. And, you know, they might have an amazing process for those web developers, and you can't just lift those pieces and say like, this new thing is the same as that thing. And I think once they have one data scientist in, sometimes it gets a bit better, but you know, we're normally saying like, oh, we need a junior data scientist just to see if we can do anything cool in this space, you know, and then you hire somebody who's like never worked in a big organization, and the majority of their job is only going to be successful if they're capable of navigating a big organization. So again, so much pressure on top of do the machine learning that makes us 10% more money. You know, it's already an insane job to ask any one person to do. But they're not going to be able to hire anyone else until they can prove their value. So you normally get, you know, somebody sort of jumping through hoops for years for something to happen. And when it does happen at the end, it does make 10%. But the whole time until then, they're sort of wondering, oh, is this possible? Am I getting blocked at this stage because people don't think this is important? Like at Laborers, we had something like that. And it was just the whole time I was like, if we could just finish this thing, it would be the most valuable thing this company's done in like 2 or 3 years. But it's the only reason it's happening is because we're sort of poking people and like asking for favors and like helping somebody with some project so that they'll help us back. And it seems like so much like hustling is the word that keeps coming up, but I don't think that's a positive word. I think it's like, I hear hustling and I think like too much energy, too little results, fear.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a positive thing, but it seems to be perceived as a positive thing at the moment. But it's because it's essential to the role in a lot of places.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe to wrap up, because I've kept you here for long enough, Joe, I'm just really enjoying the conversation here, but
sure.
I'm fully aware that you're a very busy guy. But I was going to ask if you've got any advice for people that are looking to get into their first data science role. I mean, how to navigate that kind of horrible process that you've just described earlier.
Yeah, maybe it was just horrible for me. This question did stump me a bit when I looked at it, because I was just like, what would I change? My first instinct was, you know, I didn't actually do any academic background in machine learning, data science type stuff, but most of the data scientists I know didn't either. It's not really a requirement. It's sort of, you know, it's a lovely baseline to have, but we can learn it ourselves. I think most data scientists are sort of these self-studying types that will go away and they'll learn something because they're curious or because they want to know the answer and they want to be confident it's right. So I don't really think I'd do that. I think my general advice would be that a lot of organizations don't know what a data scientist is, and a lot of people don't know what a data scientist is. So if you're trying to get into the field, if you can come up with some sort of foundations to you, what you think the role has to be, what parts you like, and sort of have some confidence around that, because if we give the organizations all the ability to define what the role is, we kind of lose that for ourselves. We lose what individuals can do. So I think it's just generally be confident. You know, if you can get anywhere, if you can learn a programming language, if you can confidently maneuver a business or do anything with machine learning, you're doing fantastically as a technical person and you're only going to do better. So just try and believe in yourself, I suppose. I guess I'll take that advice myself now as well.
yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think we could all believe in ourselves a little bit more. Don't you agree?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I always say, like, if I could just see myself the way everybody else I know sees me, I'd probably be a lot happier.
Yeah. Yeah, it's important just to check it and remember that, you know. All right, well, I'll let you get on with the rest of your day, but I've really enjoyed it. Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform.